Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Valerie Metcalf, studio potter and a founding member of Stonework Gallery, a ceramic studio, retail shop, teaching space here in Winnipeg, and the longest-running artist cooperative in Canada. Valerie graduated with an honors Bachelor of Fine Arts degree from the School of Art at the University of Manitoba, where she discovered her love of making pots and a sense of the miraculous qualities of clay. Valerie's work has many influences from teachers and fellow artists to the wide open skies, deep woods, and landscapes of the open prairies. Valerie's pottery has been exhibited nationally, internationally, and is held in numerous private and public collections throughout North America, Europe, and Asia. The province of Manitoba often presents her work to visiting dignitaries, including governor generals, the King and Queen of Sweden, President of Iceland, and more. Valerie is here tonight to tell us more about studio pottery and what is involved in running a cooperative gallery. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Susan.
You mentioned in your artist statement that you're inspired by the wide open skies, our forests, and our prairie landscapes. Can you tell us how you express these natural elements in your work, perhaps by describing a piece or a series?
I would say the influence is expressed in the color that I use. When you work with porcelain, you're able to show the true color of the glazes. And of course, as you know, our landscape is often pretty monochromatic. And I feel that through expressing color in my work, it helps to balance that sense of vast whiteness, white and blueness that we experience most of the year. And I also use nature-inspired design, leaves, patterns that kind of invoke being in the forest or the way the light falls on them, the randomness that also creates a pattern.
So when you started out, did you experiment a lot with various materials till you got to the porcelain and doing functional or decorative pottery? How did you discover your preference?
I would say through experimentation. I was lucky enough right from the beginning to have access to a high fire reduction kiln, and that very much influenced the type of glazes and clay I would use. And everybody kind of starts out with stoneware. And when I tried porcelain, that's when I fell in love with what you could do with the pattern and color effects with it. But you are able to find a lot of depth through the high fire method. What we do is we reduce the available oxygen in the kiln. And because the fire still has to burn, it pulls the oxygen from the clay and the glaze. And this creates a marriage of the two that you can't find in other forms of firing, and a depth of color that you would only see in nature.
When you use porcelain, do you also throw the clay?
Oh, yes. It's right from the box.
Okay.
Right from a piece of mud. And that's why it's there's a bit of a sense of alchemy, because you take something that's, you know, basically earth, and you turn it into precious material. At one point in history, porcelain was prized more than gold, in China specifically.
And what's your secret to throwing the clay well and getting it centered, and how long did it take you to reach that level of skill?
I was a slow learner, and I would say it probably took me about 6 months to learn how to center. And as far as learning how to throw really well, it's like learning a musical instrument. It's lots and lots and hours of practice. I'd say at least 15 years of long hours before your skill is finally starting to develop. But even at that point, there's always refinement and striving to make something better. There was a famous Japanese potter named Shoji Hamada who said it takes a lifetime and a half to be a good potter.
Do you have a vision of what you want your piece to look like before you start? And can you describe how it feels as the clay moves and forms under your touch?
I do have vision of a form or effect I'd like to create. That often changes as I'm working. Such a fluid thing. It is very much like music. So I would say throwing is the most pleasurable part when it's going well. There's a rhythm to it. There's a satisfaction and an immediacy in being able to shape something as to how you're envisioning it. And that, again, just comes with practice.
Can you describe a piece that you may have done recently or exhibited recently, explaining the colors and the lines, you know, what you really enjoyed most about it?
I guess I could talk about the piece that's in the cookbook that with the art gallery I don't know if you're aware that at Crafted 2018, the art gallery has produced a cookbook where they united local chefs with local potters, and then the chefs created a soup recipe, and the magazine is very high quality production, so they're selling it for $10 a piece to raise money for Harvest.
Nice.
So the bowl that I submitted to be considered for that is one of my Forest Bowls series. I don't know if you're aware of the death of the Parker wetlands recently, but that was an issue that I felt very strongly about, and I created some pieces to capture the essence of the forest that was destroyed. So the bowl is on a pedestal. It's open and wide, and in the center, it's framed in white with a white base, and in the center is a deep green, almost black background with leaves that are swirling around and painted with a green and a white, like a blue-green and a white, and there's a bit of softness to it because they run a bit during the firing. Then I added some gold luster to the pattern to create another sense of depth to it and also to add value to that sense of the forest and the leaves. Anyway, the forest is all gone now. It's a tragedy.
It is. Who are some of your most influential teachers, models, or master potters?
Well, I studied under Robert Archambault and Charlie Scott, who passed away. Irish Flynn, who I think is still making pots in Montana, but he's retired. They were a major influence, as well as John Waddell, who started up the gallery here. And apart from that, I've always just loved looking at books and pieces. There's so many great ceramic artists out there. I've always loved the Japanese and Chinese pottery, the fineness and the exquisite form it has. That was definitely a major influence. And I think I'm also influenced by my British heritage. So maybe people have said that my work looks old and new at the same time. So that's kind of nice. I think of that as a compliment.
There's some amazing British ceramicists.
Yes.
Stonework Gallery has recently celebrated 40 successful years of art sales and exhibitions. That's a major accomplishment across the country. From your perspective, how does a cooperative differ from others, and what do you feel has been the foundation of your gallery's success?
I think the cooperative has been successful because the quality of the work in it is exceptional. We have made an effort. When we've had openings, we've made an effort to recruit people whose work will be different and yet complementary to what we have in here. And it's only pottery. For some reason, ceramics seems to be a particularly strong creative expression in Manitoba, probably due to the strength of the school of art during the 60s and early 70s. How it would be different from a commercial gallery would be that each artist here gets a significant area to display their work. So you can really see their vision and what they're trying to do. It's not just having three or four pieces here and there and displayed sort of helter-skelter amidst other pieces. Apart from that, I can't really speak to commercial galleries because, you know, we are one, but we're not like, you know, one where we have shows or anything like that. Like the work is constantly new work coming out as the artists work. And then all of us do show in other places, like other commercial galleries in town or outside town. Technically, it's not a cooperative in that the membership is limited. Technically, it's a limited partnership. I think a cooperative has to be completely open to however members want to join. We have figured out over the years the fairest way to treat everyone so that if there are problems, people are free to speak up. We try to delegate volunteer jobs for people to ensure that everything gets done. We keep really strict books and records, all done by hand still, of course, because we're pre-computer and we're too old to change and we can't figure out how to do it. So. But that's, you know, it seems to have worked. That's a very important part of running a cooperative, is knowing exactly how much money everybody needs to put in every month to make sure the bills can be paid and that you know you're not running into trouble.
If you were to encourage new and established potters to become members of your gallery, what kind of advice would you give them?
That they need to be prepared to produce a lot of work. I know when people have been hesitant about joining, it is because it's a big commitment and there's a fair amount of space for you to fill with your work. So you have to be prepared to, you know, work hard and produce a lot.
What have you enjoyed most about being part of and a member of the Stonework Gallery?
Well, being able to make a living from my work, because if if you make a living, then you can keep working. I mean, the money is important, but the money also gives you the freedom to keep doing what you're doing. And you don't, you know, I haven't had to get a part-time job somewhere so that I can make ends meet. I've been able to, luckily, do it through the sale of my work. And that's thanks to the people of Winnipeg and visitors here who respond to the work and have made an effort to support their local artists. Very important.
Winnipeg is really helpful there. The gallery also has an impressive stoneware studio. Can you tell us a little bit about the classes and the programs you offer?
Yes, the studio originally formed the gallery. And then over the years, as people moved on or, you know, their lives evolved in different directions, the studio members invited other people to become gallery members. So right now there's only 3 members out of 15 in the gallery that own the studio. So it's a separate business. The businesses are dependent on each other. I think that part of the success of the gallery, I should have mentioned this earlier, is the fact that we do have the studio in the back so that customers can readily see and possibly experience the process that goes into making pots. And right now we have about 80 students, which is huge. Yeah. We offer 8 classes a week. We concentrate on wheel throwing and try to educate the students as much as possible in the proper techniques and ability. We offer practice time along with classes so that, because of course it's really important. And if a student wishes, they can pay extra and have unlimited access to the space. It's quite a clay community. And clay tends to establish community because there's so much work involved in firing the kiln, loading the kiln, glazing. You need to have crews that you work with. And when people also share a common passion, you know, if they fall in love with the process, really is what you fall in love with. We try to keep people distance from the finished product so they won't, you know, you have to be a bit philosophical because things don't always work out how you want. But they develop friendships and support groups, and without meaning to, the studio offers a solace to groups of people that meet here to practice and talk about their pots, and then they're always talking about their lives, and it has a whole side benefit to it that I didn't realize, you know, when we started teaching, that aspect would become so important.
I'd like to thank you so much for being our guest this evening and sharing your story and insight with our audience.
Well, thank you. Thank you for talking to me. Very happy to have been able to answer your questions.
That was Valerie Metcalf, potter and founding member of Stoneware Gallery here in Winnipeg. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Lisa Streifler, professor, photographer, painter, and innovative explorer of the effects of the subconscious on the body and how the mind-body processes intense emotional experience. Lisa works in a broad range of media along with photography and painting, such as drawing, performance, and digital imaging. Lisa grew up in Winnipeg, graduated from the School of Art at the University of Manitoba, did her MFA at Hunter College of the City University of New York, and has been the professor of visual arts at the University of Regina for a number of years. She has had numerous solo and group exhibitions across Canada, an exhibit in Bulgaria, and one coming up in London, England. Her works are held in major public collections, including the Canadian Museum of Contemporary Photography at the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa, the Canada Council Art Bank in Ottawa, the Mackenzie Art Gallery in Regina, and the Winnipeg Art Gallery. Hello, Lisa, and welcome to Art World Innovators. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Susan. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Your current exhibition, Not the Camera, but the Filing Cabinet, Performative Body Archives and Contemporary Art at the University of Winnipeg. Can you tell us about this exhibit and what is the main focus?
It's a group exhibition, 10 women artists, and I haven't seen the exhibition yet because I wasn't able to be there for the opening, but it runs till the end of November, so I'll be there soon to see it. So the women artists work in a range of media, ranging from my work, which is painting and drawing, to sculpture and photography, audio, performance. Those are all the media. The women were chosen, you know, by the curator, who is a young curator who just graduated from the University of Winnipeg and is now doing her master's in Toronto. Her name's Noor Bangu, who I'm very impressed with. And she chose the artist based on the concept for the show. So actually, I don't know any of the other artists. So I'm looking forward to seeing their work and hopefully meeting some of them. So we were brought together because all of our works in different ways address the female body and how the body signifies various struggles that women face, and in a way that promotes agency and shows strength. So it's, the show is about struggle and challenges, but it's also a very empowered show in terms of how the artists are confronting or dealing with these various issues.
So, for example, In Extremis, held at the Mackenzie Art Gallery a number of years ago, seems to be one of your exhibits that also illustrates how you're not afraid to take your viewers into the depths of their souls, with some difficult images leading to some rather difficult questions. What have you discovered over the years about how the mind-body processes intense emotional experiences from viewing such images and asking such provocative questions? Can you share with us a few audience responses to your exhibits?
Sure. That was quite a while ago. That one was 1992, and it was In Extremis. In Latin means near death. And so in that show, I was using animal bodies. So they were all specimens that I photographed behind the scenes, you know, in the preparatory area of a museum. So I was examining death. There was also actually three pieces that were photographed in hospitals, just the rooms and the equipment, no people. It is a very difficult subject, of course, and very hard to confront. But I was trying to talk about the fragility of life and using the animals metaphorically to talk about human life. I wanted the pieces to convey a sense of urgency and also to evoke a sensitivity in viewers, a sense of empathy. So it might have been a very beginning for me to deal with that subject. And I think probably that body of work dealt with the subject of death more than any work I've ever done.
Well, it sort of gives you a sense of the struggles and challenges that we face in discussing something as difficult as death, leading into the struggles and challenges that women have to face.
For women, the big issue is identity. That's another thing that this show, U of W, addresses. So there's women of color in this show. There's women of various gender identities. And I myself, I'm pretty sure I'm by far the oldest artist. So I have one painting. Well, I have one painting for sure dealing with aging, but I have another drawing that deals with it also. So we're all coming at the issue of our identities, and which are very different, but we all are trying to come to terms with them, and how we're received, you know, as women culturally, and memories of how we became who we are today and experiences we've faced. All the work is very personal, you know, and very autobiographical, I would venture to say.
Actually, I did get to see it, and it was quite good. There were a lot of different media and different types of work to show their struggles and challenges. How do you blend your photography with painting and other media? Are there certain themes and processes that you enhance in the mix?
Actually, the work that's on exhibit there doesn't have any photographic sources. So I really basically do two types of work. One is like the show In Extremis that you mentioned that is photo-based. And so when I work on photographs, I take the photographs myself. I did a series that was shown quite a bit called Normal, where I photographed myself and then I drew on top of myself. And I also wrote text on top of myself. So that's one body of work I do where I scan the images and then I do a drawing on top of the photograph and I scan that. And so it's digitally produced. But the work lately, actually, I haven't been doing photo-based work. I've been back to the basics of drawing and painting. So the works at the University of Winnipeg are purely drawing and painting. So there's three works that are ink and gouache, which is kind of like a watercolor, and these special artist crayons that I love, on paper, and then one that's acrylic paint on canvas. So I actually, you know, it's very direct to only work, you know, with immediately the immediacy of drawing or painting, whereas the photographic work, I also work intuitively and directly. You know, I have to be a little bit more calculated and plan it a bit more so the drawing and the photograph work together.
You have coming up Mentoring Artists for Women. You're going to be doing the lecture there, and there was a painting in the advertisement, Managing Chaos, in the ink and the gouache and crayons. Can you tell us a little bit about that work, and is it going to be here?
Actually, that work is not going to be, well, I'll probably show it, actually, in my talk, because the talk that I'm giving will be slide illustrated, so there'll be lots of images of my work, for sure, that I'll be talking about.
Okay.
And that's a piece from 2014, and it's a small piece, about 11 by 14 inches, and it's gouache on paper. The central image is a woman, and her arms are kind of going as if she was dancing up and down. They look like they're moving up and down. And there's a bright, bright green background and pink polka dots moving around. It was, you know, it's very intuitive, like all my work is. Actually, that work was made in Scotland. I was on a residency in Scotland near Dundee for 2 weeks in a castle.
Nice.
So it was really a wonderful experience for me. And all I did all day was make art, because when you're, you know, at a residency, the food is prepared and everything's taken care of. So it's just like a fantastic lifestyle for a couple weeks. So I made that there, and I use a woman's image in practically all my work. And so the image doesn't look like me, but, you know, it is about me. And I title my works later, but I thought she looked as if she was, you know, all those pink polka dots were chaos, were, you know, different types of chaos floating around that she was kind of trying to keep at bay, almost like a juggler.
Oh, yeah.
And there's one in her head, right at her forehead. So that's, you know, like the brain, what's in her mind. And it's a playful work, actually. So what I did with that work, I used photography, actually, in a different way. So I photographed, I took a high-resolution photograph of the painting, the drawing. It's a drawing painting, you know, on paper, but took a high-resolution photograph, and then I enlarged it and made a print, a photographic print of it, which I'm very, very pleased with. So it was actually at a MAWA auction, I think this year. So I have a few versions of it. So I have more than one. I don't make a large, you know, large edition, but up to 15 would be the largest number. And so, you know, more people can have the image, and I can experiment with different sizes too. So I've made it a lot bigger than the original. So that's actually become a favorite image of mine.
So why don't you tell us a little more about the lecture coming up at MAWA, and that will be on October 21st at Cinematique on Arthur Street at 2.
Right. I'm calling it Gender Matters. So I liked that because it can mean, you know, that gender really matters, or matters of gender. So I'm going to deal with both of those things. What I've decided to do is talk about my life growing up in Winnipeg and how I was influenced by living in Winnipeg, and then going to the School of Art for my first degree. And I'm going to go on to my master's degree when I lived in New York and stayed there for 6 years. And then I'm going to continue on with my life as professor at the University of Regina, where I've been for 3 decades, a little bit more than 3 decades, and how that's influenced my work and my life. All along, I'm going to interweave into my talk women artists who've influenced me. And so I'll be showing their work and my work together. And there's a lot of them, so I have to be selective. You know, I could talk for probably 3 hours, but the talk is only 45 minutes with 15 minutes for questions. So I'm going to have to be quite selective, but there's a lot that I want to pack into the talk. It's sort of a homecoming for me.
Can you tell us a little bit more about being a professor and, you know, some of your focus, and what do you find most rewarding about teaching?
Well, because I've done it over such a long period of time, it's really evolved. It's different now than it was long time ago. I'm a different age in relation to my students, all that. I find it rewarding to nurture young artists. So it's very fitting that MAWA would be interested in having me speak, because MAWA is all about mentoring, and I feel that my teaching is about mentoring. So that's how I approach it. I try to nurture young artists. I try to understand where they're coming from and where they want to get to help them. Of course, I have to teach them skills in the early classes, and I love teaching drawing and painting. Those are the areas that I teach. And we also have a graduate program, so that's very rewarding too. I think, though, the thing I find probably the most rewarding is talking about the ideas and, you know, what students are trying to convey and trying to help them. I think for me, I'm very interested in lots, a broad range of artists' work. So I have lots of books and I show a lot of images so students can learn from other people's work. That exposure is a really big thing to me. And I really learn a lot from teaching too, because I have to, you know, solve problems. And lots of times that takes me into areas that I wouldn't normally go into for my own practice. So it's pushed me to appreciate different things than I normally would, and to learn techniques that I, you know, don't do myself. So a lot of these things have influenced my work. And right now I'm teaching a new class with an art historian. So it's 50% studio, 50% art history. And we're focusing on the Renaissance because that's his area, talking about Michelangelo and Da Vinci. And now I'm going to try silver point, which is, you know, a Renaissance technique for drawing with a stick of silver. So, you know, I wouldn't in my wildest dreams have thought that I would do that, because my work is very bold and contemporary. So I wouldn't think that I would go there. I wouldn't have thought that a few years ago. As I'm researching it, because I think it would be good for the students, I'm getting pretty excited about trying it myself.
There's a lot of advantages to working with an art historian as well. So it's nice to come up with some new techniques to explore.
Mm-hmm. This is a new concept that we have figured out here at the University of Regina. And we've done this with sculpture and art history. And now this is the first iteration with drawing and art history. So it's great for some of the students have never drawn before. They're art history majors. And some don't love art history that much, but they're very strong in studio. So this is a very palatable way for them to take an art history class. Today we visited the biology lab here on campus because we're going to draw specimens, and that was extremely exciting. So we were getting ready to carry all these specimens back to the visual arts department, and then we just had an idea, why don't we bring the students to the biology department? And that's what we're going to do. So our class next week will be in the biology department. We're going to draw monkey skeletons and all kinds of things. I think there was I can't even remember what it's called. It was in formaldehyde. It was a fascinating image anyway.
Sounds like Damien Hirst.
Yeah, it does sound like Damien Hirst. That's exactly what it's like. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Students should see, they won't know who Damien Hirst is probably, but we should show them. Should definitely show them. We're focusing so much on Da Vinci. That's who we're thinking about, but very Damien Hirst. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, yeah, it's been great. Thank you very much.
That was Lisa Streifler, photographer, painter, and professor, speaking with us from the University of Regina. Hope you catch her exhibition on now at the University of Winnipeg. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.